This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Alyssa Block. A new federal rule has angered fishermen in Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas. The rule, which took effect today, is a ban on fishing for red snapper. That's one of the most popular saltwater fish. Federal agencies and environmental groups say that in the South Atlantic, the red snapper is in trouble. And along with the ban, officials propose temporarily closing a huge area to virtually all fishing. NPR's Greg Allen has the story.
To people who don't fish or live in the Southeast, it might seem like a lot of fuss over one species. But in fishing communities like St. Augustine, Florida, the red snapper is more than just a fish. It's the reason thousands of anglers come here each year to fish on their own or to go out with charter boat captains like Robert Johnson.
In all honesty, I can tell you that snapper fish is better today than it was 10 years ago.
Robert Johnson has fished for red snapper here off the eastern coast of Florida for nearly 30 years. When his charter business slows down, he also fishes for them commercially. He just returned from a day trip where he and his mate used hook and line to catch nearly 100 red snapper, now packed on ice. Johnson reaches into a cooler and pulls one out.
He's probably 24, 25 inches, about 6-7 pounds. That's about an average size snapper. We do catch 20 and 30 pound fish, though.
That's a key point. Red snapper can live to 50 years old and grow to 20 pounds or more. Fish that old and big are very rare, though, a clear indication, scientists say, of how much they've been overfished. Today, the National Marine Fisheries Service estimates the population of red snapper off the Atlantic coast is just 3% of what it was 60 years ago. Because of that, the service has put in place a 6-month interim ban on fishing for red snapper, with an option to extend it further. Regional Administrator for the National Marine Fisheries Service in the Southeast is Roy Crabtree. He says the science leaves little doubt that the population of red snapper in the South Atlantic has been severely depleted.
I think the only real debate is the extent of the overfishing, but I don't believe there is a whole lot of scientific debate about whether the stock is undergoing overfishing or overfished.
Robert Johnson and others in the recreational fishing industry questioned the methodology used to estimate the red snapper population. Their doubts are supported by the National Research Council, which has called into question the government's process for estimating catches and fish populations. Johnson believes that while red snapper have been overfished, limits on catches have done a lot in recent years to help rebuild the species.
They still keep claiming we're fishing at 8 times the sustainable rate, and I just don't see that being true. If that was the case, then we would see the stock and our catch per unit effort, the amount of fish we're catching per trip, would fall. It would not be consistently the same over the last 10 years, and it definitely wouldn't be getting better.
For Robert Johnson, there's a lot at stake. He says at least 60% of his customers come out to fish for red snapper or other bottom species like grouper, also now off limits. And even more alarming than the red snapper ban is another proposal now being considered. It would close some 10,000 square miles of the Atlantic from North Carolina to Florida to virtually all fishing. Johnson says that will likely put him and the 24 other charter captains here in St. Augustine out of business and take a toll on the restaurants, hotels, and others in town who benefit from the influx of anglers. Holly Benz with the Pew Environment Group's campaign to end overfishing in the Southeast says people who want to fish will still have other options.
I think it's important to keep in mind that 80% of what recreational fishermen caught in the waters off the coast of these 4 states last year will still be open for fishing.
Benz concedes, however, that communities in areas like St. Augustine that depend on red snapper will be the hardest hit. That's something Dave Workman already knows.
I can get sentimental real quick about this. My father started taking me fishing at 6 years old. It was a big deal. I mean, it's a legacy. And they're talking about completely shutting down fishing completely.
Workman owns The Strike Zone, a fishing outfitter in Jacksonville that carries everything from reels and tackle to kayaks. He says customers have already stopped buying fishing tackle, and he expects business to get much worse once the red snapper ban goes into effect. Like others in the industry, Workman thinks the government has greatly underestimated the ban's economic impact.
They're talking about it would be $3 million for the state of Florida. And they said 10% of that would be the tackle retailers. That's $300,000. Between my two stores, it'll cost more than that in yearly sales.
A group called the Recreational Fishing Alliance has filed a lawsuit seeking to block the red snapper ban from taking effect on January 4th as planned. Federal regulators may decide whether to approve the larger area ban when it meets in March. Meanwhile, a bipartisan group in Congress from coastal districts is working on a bill that would require federal regulators to consider the impact on local economies before ordering fishery closings in the future. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
The nation's economic woes have been particularly hard on the dairy industry. Milk prices are at historic lows, and many dairy farmers are going bankrupt. Still, some farmers have found a way to survive. They've gone organic. NPR's Kathleen Masterson visited an organic family farm in northern Vermont.
At this hour, well before dawn, the only light around is coming from the barn. Tim McShillow and his teenage son, Max, are milking the herd, hooking each cow up to a pump which sends the milk to a central stainless steel tank. The barn smells like cow breath and hay. Tim's wife, Kristen Dellert, is bottle feeding the 9 baby cows, including the one born in the pasture a few hours ago.
We're milking about 42 right now. It takes me about an hour and a half to milk.
For 3 years now, Tim and Kristen have been running an organic farm. That means the cows have to get feed grown without pesticides. They can't have antibiotics or growth hormones either. And for at least 3 months a year, the cows have to be out on pasture.
I drive out there and I'll sit and have my coffee and call them. I'll call them and they'll slowly get up. I'll have to get out and roust a few up. And then they slowly make their way to the barn. Hello, Sassy. Hello, Sassy. Ooh.
The gingerbread's showing me. I love you guys. It's all Christmas special.
The family home is tucked amid the low green hills of Coventry, Vermont. From the breakfast table, they can see the cows grazing out back. This farm is making it now, but it wasn't always. A few years ago, Tim and Kristen tried running a conventional dairy.
Well, actually, we moved up here from Connecticut because Tim wanted to be a dairy farmer. And as a speech pathologist, I could work just about anywhere.
That was in 2000. Right away, Kristen says, they realized it was going to be a lot of work, hands-on work.
The first time I went into the barn and Tim says to me, "That cow is in labor over there. You need to check her." "No, put a glove on and make sure the nose and feet are coming out." And I'm like, "I have a master's degree."
Kristen learned how to birth a baby cow and many other dairy chores. Through it all, she kept her full-time day job. But still, they weren't making enough to live on.
Tim said, "You know, we're working 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we don't get to set the price for our product." He said, "This is crazy." So we sold the cows, and Tim did his own construction business for a while, excavating business. I kept working.
But after a couple of years with an empty barn, they decided to try again. This time, they would go organic. One reason was the money. These days, conventional farmers are actually getting paid less for their milk than it costs them to produce it.
They're losing their shirts, basically, mm-hmm. just to stay in the business.
Meanwhile, organic farmers are selling their milk for a slim profit. They're getting about a dollar more per gallon than conventional. So you might think all conventional farms would be going organic right now. But Kristen and Tim say it's not for everybody. For one thing, you have to know your cows pretty well. Their son Max can name every cow, even from across the pasture.
And then we have Bean, who was Coffee's baby, and then Glaze, who was Donut's baby.
And Lisa Marie, who's Presley's baby.
If a cow is getting sick, they know right away. That's important, because organic farmers can't give their animals antibiotics. It's a lot of work, and it's expensive. The organic feed costs more, and so do the organic remedies for sick cows. But Kristen says it's worth it.
We actually think they're healthier because we find they're under less stress because mm-hmm. they get to go out. Cows love being out on pasture. They're meant to eat grass. Right. So anything else that you give them puts them under stress.
Tim and Kristen have had a lot of help learning how to run an organic farm. They're part of a co-op called Organic Valley. It helps by marketing and distributing the milk. Kristen says being part of a co-op allows each farm to be more than just a milk factory.
Because it truly does give farmers an alternative in terms of how they're treated and what's being done with our milk.
Still, in today's economy, even organic farmers are feeling the pinch. Tim and Kristen's dairy is making just enough for both of them to be full-time farmers, but they've had to make some cutbacks.
We've let our hired help go because we have to reduce our costs. So now it's just the three of us.
They've had to postpone plans to expand, but still Tim and Kristen feel lucky their dairy is in the black. And they trust the organic movement will weather the economic downturn. Kathleen Masterson, NPR News.
In this country, President Obama is promoting green jobs. They're supposed to help both the environment and the economy, but it turns out that new green jobs may simply replace older jobs. NPR's Chris Arnold has the latest report in our series, New Jobs for a New Decade.
Many old factories around the country now sit dark and empty. But at a once-defunct Polaroid film factory in New Bedford, Massachusetts, the lights are on again. And a new industry is rising up inside the ruins of an old one.
Well, we make what's called plastic solar cells. We call it Power Plastic.
Rick Hess is the CEO of Canarca. It's a company that makes solar panels, but not like any you've probably seen before. These are thin, flexible plastic sheets. They're lightweight, and some are transparent, so they can be built into windows to let homes or office buildings generate their own solar power. Or the material can be sewn onto a bag or briefcase. And even something that small will generate electricity.
It's enough to charge cell phones or iPods or things like that.
Oh, really? So you could charge your cell phone.
Oh, you can clearly charge your cell phone. I have a bag that I use today that I use to charge my cell phone.
The equipment at this factory used to make big sheets of Polaroid film. Canarca converted it so that these same machines are now churning out these film-like solar panels. And the company's hired back about 20 of the former Polaroid workers to run the factory. So it's given new green jobs to workers who had been laid off. Mike Page is an electrician and machine operator.
You know, I invested my whole career at Polaroid, and then I thought it was over. And now I feel renewed, and I feel like I have a whole new future.
Green jobs are a very big deal in Washington. President Obama has said that he wants to create 5 million new green jobs over 10 years.
The nation that leads in clean energy will be the nation that leads the world. I want America to be that nation.
And it's definitely an attractive idea. So if you want the country to go green, when at the same time it needs a lot more jobs, green jobs seem like the perfect solution. But
even if we hit numbers like 5 million jobs that people talk about, and that's quite plausible, that can only be a very limited piece of the puzzle in a country with several hundred million people.
Michael Levy is a senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations. He says that proponents often only talk about the jobs that will be created, not the jobs that will be lost. And the economy is a big interconnected system. So here's an example. The country only needs so much electricity, but if more of that comes from wind power or solar power, less is going to come from coal. So some coal miners would lose their jobs. Levy says anytime the government pushes the economy in a given direction, you'll gain jobs in some areas and lose them in others.
Let's say I add 5 million jobs and I lose 4 million jobs elsewhere, and it's over 10 years. Within the grander scheme of things, it's other elements of economic policy that are going to change people's lives.
There's also the question of what gets counted as a, quote, green job. The numbers get very mushy here. What about electricians who already have a job but who start installing more efficient furnaces? Should those be counted as new green jobs? Levy thinks that many green jobs will really just be existing jobs that are shifted into this category. Still, other experts see green jobs as a lot more important.
This is at the center of the future of American competitiveness.
Bracken Hendricks is a senior fellow at the liberal think tank, the Center for American Progress. He says, take the global auto industry. If companies here in the U.S. can come up with the best electric car technologies,
we're talking about who is going to own the growth of the auto industry globally. In China, they're about to go from 65 million cars on the road to 300 million cars on the road.
Basically, people's views on green jobs depend on their vision of the future. Congressman Ed Markey authored clean energy and green jobs legislation that was recently passed by the House.
We have to think of this as the next great job-creating sector in the same way that we put the correct telecommunications policies on the books in the 1990s that led to an explosion of Made in America brands, Google, eBay, Amazon.
In the shorter term, the Obama administration is interested in giving Americans incentives to insulate their homes. The idea is to put thousands of contractors to work with insulation and caulk guns. So it's being called Cash for Caulkers. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
Our series, New Jobs for a New Decade, continues tomorrow with a look at healthcare workers.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. In the Middle East, oil was the resource that defined the last century. Water and its scarcity may define this one. The Middle East is facing the worst water crisis in many decades. For three summers, the annual rains have failed to come. We have the first story now in a two-part series on water in the Middle East and the phenomenon of water refugees. NPR's Deborah Amos begins her report in Syria.
This winter rain barely settles on the hard-cracked farmland in northern Syria. There was a time when these fields were green, but the summer droughts have taken a toll. Driving further east is the Badia, a vast rangeland where thousands of people tend herds of sheep. Adame is a traditional village. The houses are white domes of baked clay. This summer, Adame was completely abandoned during the driest months. There was no water and too much sand. It got into everything, even the kitchen, says Nofat Hamid.
Sand got in your kitchen?
Yeah, it was crazy. The sand was everywhere this summer, she says. Life has never been easy here, but Ismar Muhammad, a 43-year-old shepherd who's wrapped in a black wool robe against the cold, says he was wealthy by local standards. He owns the largest herd. He had to drive his flock more than 150 miles for water. With no luck and no grass, he had to buy feed for his sheep.
275 heads.
And did you have to sell some to feed them?
No question. I had to do this, otherwise they would die, and also I need to feed my kids. Before the drought, I'm talking about, I used to have 400 heads.
So at one moment you were actually doing well at this business.
No question, we were doing fine, just except for this drought has affected us very badly.
In Syria, more than 160 villages are abandoned now. According to a United Nations report, 800,000 people have lost their livelihoods. Hundreds of thousands of them walked off once fertile land that turned to dust and pitched tents near the big cities, looking for any kind of work.
Until now, it's an emergency. If we have two more years of drought, I'm sure then we can say we do have a crisis.
Syrian economist Nabil Sukar, formerly with the World Bank, now heads a private consulting firm for development and investment. He's been researching the emergency, including its economic and social costs.
I've gone out and I saw some people in the tents. I told them, where are you coming from? How do you manage? They said, we find short-term work, but this is not sustainable.
The mass migration to the cities has created a new community of displaced people across Syria and Iraq.
So yes, water scarcity is forcing people off the land, and therefore these refugees are very much water refugees, or water. They're a product of water scarcity in the region.
That's Hussein Amri, an expert on Middle East water management and the policy failures that have made the emergency worse. On a visit to the region, this professor at the Colorado School of Mines says the water crisis has been building for years.
The water refugees are a product of climate change, mismanaged water resources. It's a product of population explosion. It's a lot of things. It's a perfect storm of sorts that is wreaking havoc in the rural farming sector in Syria and Iraq.
The Syrian city of Palmyra, due east of the capital, is a tourist destination. The Roman ruins are a draw for these Japanese visitors and one livelihood for the locals.
Five camels.
Already.
But Palmyra, hit hard by the drought, is also a headquarters for the government response. Emergency measures include food aid for families, low-cost loans for farmers. At the Office for Development, Mohsan Nahas says Palmyra is experimenting with new water-saving techniques.
Yes. بالنسبه للبادي الواحات.
Yes, I have talked about the oasis we've been setting up here. That's being done with drip irrigation, only drip irrigation.
Nahas shuttles through a slideshow to explain what he's up against. A dust storm so large it could be seen from space on Google. Conditions on the ground were intolerable.
You see the sand?
it's a ball of sand that's coming towards the tent.
Yes, it is coming to their houses. It's coming to the tents. It's even melting and mixing with the food, and it's affecting their eyes. You see this kid? He can't see because of the sand.
And with a widespread drought, a food crisis is looming. For the first time, Syria had to import wheat. Economist Nabil Sukar says things won't get better unless the country changes a history of wasteful water management and outdated farming techniques.
Unfortunately, we have not introduced modern technology, and so we are dependent on rainfall, period.
But rainfall, or lack of it, is not the only culprit, he says. Syria and Iraq blame Turkey's huge network of dams on the Tigris and Euphrates River for reducing water supplies by 50%. Turkey is the site of the headwaters of the rivers that Syria and Iraq depend on. An informal agreement determines the flow downstream.
When we had bad relationships with Turkey, they reduced the flow of water despite the agreement. And now, thank God, we have excellent relations with Turkey, and hopefully we will not see any cutoff of water.
Turkey says there's enough water for everyone. But Syria and Iraq waste their share. Hussein Amri says the Turks are partly right.
The issue is water, but it actually goes far beyond water.
Amri says the key to head off a water crisis is more efficient management of a scarce resource. But he adds politics, not climate, is the problem.
A lot of Arabs believe that Turkey is trying to assert itself as a regional superpower, and water is being used as a tool to advance that interest.
In the second part of our series on water, Turkey's plans for the Euphrates River Basin and growing tensions as the Fertile Crescent becomes drier and warmer. Deborah Amos, NPR News.
In the introduction to her book, Lives of the Trees, author Diana Wells offers this warning. This book is not for botanists or dendrologists or taxonomists or even for those who want to identify individual trees. It is a book for non-experts like me. Well, she might as well have added it's a book for tree lovers, people like me, who are intrigued by trees, our relationship with them, the stories behind their names, and other interesting tidbits of information about them. That alder, for instance, is the best wood for underwater construction, which explains why much of Venice still stands on alder wood pilings, or that botanically, bananas aren't even really trees, but instead giant herbs. Well, in her book, Diana Wells writes about 100 trees, arranged in alphabetical order, from acacia to willow, and more. And she joins me now. Diana, why did you decide to write this book?
Well, because I am a lover of trees. They're so much part of our lives, both in ways we know and ways we don't know. I challenge almost anyone listening to be further than 2 feet away from something that came from a tree, whether it be a cup of coffee or a Kleenex or your rubber tires on your automobile. They are very much bound in our life, and these days, of course, we know that they're essential to our planet.
Of all the trees that you wrote about and researched, which one still lives on in your imagination?
The stewartia is a tree which I'm very fond of because it's in my garden, and it's an absolutely lovely little tree. It comes from Japan, and it has lovely white flowers in the summer when not much else is blooming, and it has a flaky bark.
Is this the tree that you looked out on when you were writing this book?
Yes, you've got it just right. It is exactly the tree I looked out on. The willow is a tree, weeping willow, I like, because of its name. Its botanical name is Salix babylonica, which means it's a willow, Salix, from Babylon. In fact, it's not from Babylon at all. It's from China. But it was called that from a mistranslation of the Bible when the Jews were exiled to Babylon. And they wept when they remembered Zion, and they hung their harps on the willows, which was supposed then to have stayed pendant ever since.
The willow also has some interesting lore attached to it. You note that in China, willow trees were planted outside the women's part of the house. Why?
You know, I don't know why. They were supposed to be female trees, and they was always compared with dancing girls. Of course, the most famous willow is on the willow pattern tree, which is a legend about two lovers who run away, and they die, and then they become two birds which fly above the weeping willow tree.
Hmm. Each of these entries is filled with all kinds of fun facts as well. We learn that willow wood was used in England to make bats that were especially springy for playing cricket, or that charcoal from willow wood is supposed to make the best gunpowder. Who knew?
Yes, it's an interesting juxtaposition. The pomegranate is an interesting juxtaposition of philosophies, because that was considered to be the tree of life. It was used symbolically way back to represent rebirth, and brides would throw one on the doorstep when they came in to see, be sure they had many children. But then, somewhere along the line, we got the grenade, which was from the fruit, granata. And that, of course, as we know, is a weapon. It always seems to me a little ironic that the life-giving tree should also be a weapon of destruction.
Can I ask you about breadfruit? Because this is includes a story that many of us have learned about and read about, and who can resist a good story about Captain Bligh?
Yes, well, the breadfruit was something that could just be used on its own as a food, really. And it sustained whole cultures. And the idea was that it would be a cheap food for slaves, so that's why Captain Bligh went to get it on the Bounty. They wanted it to survive, so he gave up his cabin, the best cabin, for it. And the problem was that sailors thought that the water was being used for the breadfruit and they weren't getting enough. So that's how the mutiny started. Then, actually, eventually, they did have another cargo of breadfruit that went to St. Vincent, but the slaves in the end didn't eat it.
I have to ask you about the Japanese cedar, in part because it looks like such a beautiful tree, but also because you introduce the reader to a ritual there that I was not familiar with, the tradition of forest bathing.
Yes, I love that ritual. You go into the forest and sort of soak yourself in the trees. You don't take off your clothes or anything, and it's called forest bathing. And apparently businessmen in Japan still do it. I actually do it quite a bit. Quite often we'll walk in the woods and just let the trees, you know, feel as though I'm part of the forest. And it's very, very soothing. It's beautiful.
What do you want people to do with this book? How do you want people to use it in their lives?
Well, I think it would be nice if they got to know the trees around them and if it inspires them to do that. I think that it would help us if we were more familiar with the trees, because in the past people were very familiar with trees. Nowadays you can get somebody living on a street named after a tree, and they've never really seen the tree. It's just a street name. And I think if we did that, it would cement the bond, which has got a little loose between us, and it would help all of us.
Dana Wells, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Dana Wells is the author of Lives of the Trees, An Uncommon History. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. The mountains and valleys of Appalachia bear the scars of a common practice, mountaintop removal mining. It's a cheap and easy way to get coal out of the ground, but it is messy, and it's inspired a lot of controversy and lawsuits. Now a team of scientists is saying the evidence of environmental damage is so overwhelming that the practice should be stopped. NPR's Christopher Joyce explains.
You can say this for mountaintop removal mining. The name is dead on. That's exactly what mining companies do. They strip the trees from the top of the mountain, blast off the rock or overburden, and dig down to get the coal below. It's pretty efficient and cheap to mine this way. But a big problem is the coarse rock that used to be the mountaintop. It's got to go somewhere. And in Appalachia, that means down the mountainside. It becomes what's called valley fill. Margaret Palmer is a biologist with the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science who studied what happens in a valley fill.
You expose material that when it rains and water percolates through that, it dissolves a lot of chemicals. and those are very persistent in the streams below valley fill sites.
Chemicals like selenium, which can harm fish and other aquatic life, and sulfates, which alter the water chemistry. The scientists say many organisms in these valley streams, from algae to fish and birds, could be seriously harmed. Writing in the journal Science, Palmer and 11 other scientists reviewed research on the biological effects of mountaintop mining. They say those chemicals stick around.
Even after a site has been reclaimed and attempts have been made to revegetate it, the streams that remain below that weren't filled, have high levels of all sorts of nasty things.
So they say mountaintop mining should be stopped. In fact, the Environmental Protection Agency has been holding up almost 80 permits for new mines to give them extra environmental scrutiny. And at a Senate hearing last year, EPA water expert John Randy Pomponio said the agency doesn't really know how bad the stream damage is.
These little streams are like capillaries in your blood system. They're what travel through the landscape and capture the pollutants, clean those pollutants. And we frankly don't know where the tipping point is in losing one stream, five streams, 18 streams in a particular watershed.
Pomponio told the Senate that mines in some valleys are so large now, their footprint covers as much as one-third of the watershed, a watershed being the whole area through which water flows into a valley. He also said the EPA has not done a good job of assessing the cumulative effect of all this mining. While the EPA reviews the science, the mining industry in West Virginia is growing unhappy with the go-slow approach. Randy Huffman is Secretary of the state's Department of Environmental Protection.
They just shut everything down. Basically, and it kind of turned the industry on its head.
Huffman says new requests for mining permits in West Virginia are getting closer inspection from his department, and some should go ahead while regulators are looking for solutions. As for the pollutants the scientists listed, he says they've created a worst-case scenario.
If you wanted to look at 30 years of coal mining in Appalachia and pick out the worst of everything that's ever happened and put it on two pages, you could do that, and it looks like that's what's been done.
Environmental and citizens groups in Appalachia have been suing for years to stop mountaintop mining, with mixed success. But Huffman says even if mountaintop mining were outlawed, that wouldn't keep other sources of mine waste out of valleys.
We have valley fills associated with every type of mining, including underground mining.
But according to scientists who studied the region's streams, mountaintop mining is responsible for most of the damage. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.